I've said before that one of my biggest musical influences, period, is Ryan Adams. Well, I suppose I should probably say was Ryan Adams. From the time I was 12 until probably 2015 or so, I was an enormous supporter of his music. I had all the albums, some of the books, a lot of the 45s. I even went to his art show at the Morrison Hotel Gallery in 2009. I still have a print of one of his paintings hanging on my wall. It's not a great painting, but it reminds me of a great time in my life and a trip I had with my mom. So there you go. But when the New York Times published a Me Too article about Ryan Adams in 2019, I just stopped listening. Honestly, it wasn't hard to do. I'd fallen off a lot of his newer stuff. 2008's Cardinology was the last album I probably listened to in earnest, and I wasn't a huge fan. Sure, there was some good stuff on there, but it didn't hit me like his songs once had. Maybe it was me. I'm still not sure. But I'd still make efforts to see him live, despite not getting along with the newer material as much. The last time I saw him was at the Paramount Theater in Seattle after I moved here, and it was a transcendent show. Somehow, I'd been lucky over the years to mostly get sober Ryan Adams, because when that man is on his game, it's amazing. But when he's in rough shape, it's the stuff of legends. Welcome to Get Offset. My name is Emily, and I hope 2024 is off to a decent start for you. You know, on a personal level, because I can just gesture at the world vaguely. Years ago, when Andrew was still co-hosting the podcast, we talked about the Ryan Adams controversy. That's a great episode. It features Louise, formerly of Dwarfcraft Devices, and we hit on some great points, in my opinion. I think it's still one of our most listened to episodes. But following the New York Times article, I pulled all my CDs and vinyl records out of my collection and took a few posters off my wall. Again, not all of them. And taking the vinyl out of the collection was quite the thing. I had a lot, and including some records I'd paid probably extremely too much money for, like Love is Hell original pressing on vinyl. But like I've already mentioned, I hadn't been a huge listener of his work in years, though I'd occasionally still put on Love is Hell or Demolition when I was feeling nostalgic or sad. But that doesn't mean I wasn't still invested in Ryan. I'd still go see his shows, engage with him on Twitter. I was even really excited a few times when he shared my tweets to him or reposted a picture I took at one of his shows. And of course, he was a huge gearhead, something I was just getting into myself. The first time I heard of Chase Bliss was from his post on Instagram about the Tonal Recall, and I have to imagine more than one or two others discovered brands like Chase Bliss the same way, through his Instagram. He had signature pedals with JHS, who I have to applaud for offering to swap the case of their signature pedal with him for a non-Ryan Adams branded one post-New York Times article. And Walrus, who quietly sold through their stock of signature pedals before releasing a V2 that bore no Ryan Adams branding. Ryan also seemed to have been working with Fender on a signature Stratocaster, and there were rumors of other brand deals in the works. In short, Ryan Adams was nearly more famous in the gear world for being, quote, one of us, than he was for being a songwriter. To me, it was cool to see someone I'd listened to since I was a preteen finally get recognized in the mainstream. I mean, I was teased for listening to what was considered weird music as a kid, and Ryan's was at the forefront. I mean, it probably was weird for a 14-year-old to listen to alt country or whatever, but I digress. Considering those gear deals and the online obsession over his tone, it was especially big news in that gear world to hear he was, let's call it a sex pest, to put it lightly. There were tons of debates over art versus artist, and surprisingly to me, most people just kind of decided to put him out to pasture in a way. For those who had just discovered his music around the time he released his self-titled record, it probably seemed like a swift fall from grace. But if we're honest with ourselves and each other, Ryan's fall wasn't just predictable, it was par for the course. In the early 2000s, Ryan Adams was an absolute wunderkind, at least critically speaking. He was hyped to hell. His band Whiskey Town had some acclaim and some absolute bangers. Some of the songs, sure, they felt half written, second verse same as the first verse kind of shit, but some of the songs can still make me cry, underwritten or not. Listen to Faithless Street and try not to feel something. Whiskey Town also had a reputation as a live band, and not in a good way. These days, you don't hear as much about bands that are great on record or have amazing songs, but literally fight each other on stage. But in the 90s, you had Oasis, the Brian Jonestown Massacre, go watch Dig if you haven't already, and Whiskey Town. In the late 90s, I believe it was 1998, half the band quit or was fired during a gig in Kansas City. So, the last Whiskey Town album, Pneumonia, was less country, sure, but still had incredible songwriting. It's my favorite Whiskey Town record, and I have an autographed poster from the album hanging in my office. Listen, I had to do a lot of street teaming to win that poster, so it's going to stay up. In my opinion, that record is banger after banger, but the label didn't agree, and it was shelved. Until Ryan's solo career took off, that is. In 2000, he released his first solo album, Heartbreaker. Incredible record. I think we can all agree that it has some damn fine songwriting. It has some real heavy hitters on it too, and I mean on the production and the recording side. It was produced by Ethan Johns, son of Glenn Johns, who produced and engineered for the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, the Who, Eric Clapton, and more. This person, Ethan Johns, is just royalty in a lot of ways. He also had guest vocals and performances from Emmy Lou Harris, Gillian Welsh, and David Rawlings, to name a few. The critics loved it, but it didn't sell. And seriously, landing background vocals from the legendary Emmy Lou Harris was an incredible feat for a debut solo record. If I remember, Emmy Lou did it as a thank you to Ryan for a Graham Parsons tribute he participated in. And of Gillian Welsh and David Rawlings. Gillian and Dave were already fairly well known in the budding Americana, as it would come to be known, scene. And Gillian was about to be heavily featured on the Oh Brother Where Art Thou soundtrack. If you weren't around when that movie hit, the soundtrack was a huge cultural moment, especially in adult contemporary. Everybody was listening to bluegrass. I cannot stress how wild it was. I didn't complain. I love that movie, and the soundtrack is just perfection. Large thanks in no small part, I should say, to T-Bone Burnett's direction. Sorry for that digression. Let's move on. Next up for Ryan is Gold, his breakthrough record. Don't worry, I'm done going through his discography one by one after this. Though the album Gold had some adult alternative potential, Ryan didn't want to promote it to radio. He just wanted to play some live shows. I'm sure his label loved him for that. When he finally did make a video, and I think that the one that was released was the second version of this video filmed, he filmed it on September 7th, 2001 in New York City with the Twin Towers in the background. Yeah, that's 4 days before the New York City skyline was forever altered due to the terrorist attacks of 9/11. It was a national tragedy, and music had a weird part in that, and so did Ryan Adams. You hate to call an immeasurable tragedy anyone's lucky break, and I really don't want to. It's just a coincidence. But it's also a little hard to believe New York, New York would have hit and had the success it did without such wild timing. I am not going to say incredible success. The single didn't crack the Billboard Hot 100 or anything, but Gold the album reached 59 on the American Billboard charts. I know that it was my first real introduction to Ryan Adams, and I think a lot of people can say it was their first introduction to him. With Gold getting that success, Ryan also got a lot of promotional resources. He had music videos featuring Elton John and Adam Duritz from the Counting Crows, and Adam was also featured on the record Gold, the song Answering Bell. Apparently, he and Ryan had been roommates. Fascinating. He was nominated for a Grammy during that time, though not for the record Gold. If I remember correctly, it was for a Hank Williams cover he did. It was just a nice cover. In the years following, he was in a commercial for The Gap, was featured on CMT Crossroads, paired with Elton John. Amazing. He filmed an episode of Making the Video for MTV. Side note, can we bring back that series and also pop-up video? I'll get into that some other time. And he appeared on Austin City Limits for the first time. But his reputation for being, let's say, difficult, didn't end with Whiskey Town. Ever the prolific songwriter, he kept delivering albums his label deemed, quote, uncommercial or, quote, too sad. And that's probably fine. It's part of being an artist who doesn't fit into a box. And honestly, I loved a lot of the songs that never made it on an album. But the big thing was, he kept acting out on stage, and it kept making headlines. Headlines on like blogs or like small sections of popular magazines, sure, but it got attention and it was really, really negative. For example, probably the most famous example, he famously berated a fan at the Ryman in Nashville back in 2002. As the story goes, the guy kept screaming out requesting Summer of 69, the Bryan Adams song, and Ryan ordered the house lights on, gave the heckler $30 cash, and tried to kick him out. It's my understanding that the fan was allowed to re-enter the show. The way Ryan tells the story, he claims he was upset because the guy was drunk and interrupting the show for everyone else, especially during a very quiet part of the show when Gillian Welch and David Rawlings were on the stage. But the story prevails that he had a tantrum at the Ryman. And to this day, Ryan Adams does not handle hecklers or inattentive audiences with any grace. More on that later. In 2003, he left an absolutely wild voicemail on famed music critic Jim DeRogatis' answering machine. Coincidentally, DeRogatis, his reporting on R. Kelly years later would contribute to Kelly's downfall. In 2004, Ryan broke his wrist during a show in Liverpool after a 6-foot fall off the front of the stage. I remember at the time, the rumors were that he was drunk off his ass, and that's not hard to believe by his own admissions. He's also started feuds with Jack White, Father John Misty, The Strokes, and others. He released 3 albums, which is something that not even Prince would do in 2005, a few years before getting sober. I think at one point he released something like 10 albums online, most of which were joke songs with titles like Drunk Santa. It was weird, but I'll be damned if they weren't all on my iPod. And to be clear, I liked all 3 albums that came out in 2005. I was a weird kid. My favorite of those albums was 29. I was a sad kid, too. All this is to say that Ryan has always been a loose cannon. He's always been what some people might say an asshole. Rumors were that some of the original members of the Cardinals, with whom he saw a good amount of commercial success, quit because they simply didn't like working with him. And this is just my memory and rumors, but I seem to remember him starting a rumor about his then bassist's love life. She stopped working with him shortly thereafter. I don't know if those things are connected. I don't know if I dreamed that. That's my disclosure. But the fandom's response to him having a female bassist was interesting to be nice. Especially considering he did have a lot of female fans. He also had a lot of male fans, and this was, you know, 20-something years ago, nearly. But even though we knew he was kind of an asshole, he always seemed like a benign asshole to his fans. Yeah, he was unpredictable in concert, which sucked, but especially after his sobriety, this didn't seem to be the case as much. And most of his antics, if they still existed, targeted bad audience members and other musicians. And maybe you also hated Jack White. So maybe this was endearing to you and not a turnoff. So I have to be honest. I was not surprised when the New York Times article came out. And I wasn't surprised that we all saw what seemed to be the end of a persona he'd been building. This man spent a few years building up mostly goodwill with even-keeled records, being well-behaved on tour, being sober, selling himself as a totally relatable nerd who just liked guitar shit, cats, and pinball, and punk rock, and really only starting occasional fights on Twitter. And just like that, it was gone. If he had 9 lives, he may have spent the last one. What didn't help the New York Times article was his reaction to the aftermath. He never really gave an apology that made people happy, just sorry if I've hurt people kind of apology. He also never really addressed the claims except to deny them. And to be clear, the worst charge against him, that he was sexting essentially a minor, that was dropped. But whether or not he knew that girl was underage, what he did to those women was wrong. Whether or not you think how he treated Mandy Moore was akin to abuse, he was a terrible husband. Whether or not Phoebe Bridgers was, quote, down in regards to their relationship at a point, he had a position of power at the time over Bridgers, and he abused it. And her story is so similar to the stories of others. It seems like a pattern. He finds a talented woman, offers to help her career, engages her romantically, and refuses further help, maybe even holding recordings hostage if those advances aren't met with enthusiasm. And despite him claiming he didn't have the clout to make or break someone else's career, he absolutely did. He was well known. His albums got a good amount of press, and honestly, he probably did give Phoebe some of her first buzz. Others too. He took Jason Isbell on the road of a solo tour, at least one, when Jason was kind of struggling in his solo career. I'm not giving Ryan Adams any credit for Isbell's success, but he did push him in front of an audience after Isbell got sober. It was my first time in a long time, really, paying attention to Jason Isbell. And for me, that's really part of what turned me on to his music and the music of others. It probably didn't help Bryan Adams in all of this that he was considered unreliable in the music industry as a whole. He was supposed to produce a solo album for Jason and pulled out. He was supposed to produce for Liz Phair, and she called him, quote, unreliable, and said she, quote, wasn't willing to go along with his process to Vulture in 2019. She refused to specify what she meant by that, but he is most likely the unnamed producer in her memoir, Horror Stories. So if you want to read about her experience, that's most likely her experience with Ryan Adams. Honestly, one of the things that turned me off of Ryan Adams was, I think this was in like 2014 or something, he was featured on BuzzFeed saying he never really liked country music, that he just cared about punk, and that the country was, quote, appropriation. I think I'm remembering that one right. I didn't go find the article, but I do remember how that article made me feel. He got me into country music in the first place. He was my first foray into alt country and Americana, genres that define my songwriting and playing style to this day. So to hear him basically say it was all fake, I took that probably a little bit personally, to be completely honest. I'm only human. So yeah, in 2019, after the article in the New York Times came out, I just stopped following him. And I really lost track. I managed to get off of his email list, and at most, I'd see he booked some shows here or there. I remember he surprise dropped an album or two on streaming, but I didn't think much of it, and I never listened. In the past year or so, I haven't gotten even that much information about him. He simply hasn't been on my radar. He hasn't somehow been in my feed, and at most, I'd maybe see him liking some gear post online. So imagine my surprise when I'm scrolling Reddit and I see a post about Ryan Adams, and for the first time in years, I clicked. The main post mentioned he'd released 4 albums, quote, this year, and mentioned some number that he'd released over the past 18 months. Reading this on like January 7th, I assumed that the writer meant the past 12 months. No. Ryan Adams dropped 4 albums on New Year's Day, digital copies only. Apparently there's technically a 5th one. So I wondered, what the hell? What the hell else has this man been up to? Yeah, and he had quite the 2023, and I missed all of it. Somehow I didn't catch wind that he was touring. I say somehow, but I don't think he was coming anywhere near Seattle, so the promotional machine wasn't hitting me. I knew he'd been doing some solo shows. I knew he'd like sold out Carnegie Hall, which is a big deal. But he'd booked a whole tour with a newly reformed version of the Cardinals, playing all those songs that I listened to and loved in high school, especially the songs from the album Cold Roses. The thing is, the Cardinals didn't really exist anymore, and they couldn't. Two of the members from the main lineup, Neil Castle and Chris Feinstein, aka Space Wolf, had died since Ryan disbanded them. Chris, I believe it was determined to be accidental. He had some medications that interacted. That's the story. Neil Castle very tragically died by suicide, and he was very loved in Americana and the guitar world as well. So the new band featured Brad, who was the original drummer, Steven Stills' son, Chris Stills, who I think played with Ryan before. He might have been on Gold. He might have played guitar on Gold. A keyboard player whose name escapes me. And the legendary Don was president of Blue Note Records. What the hell? The reviews I saw for those shows were mixed at best. Some people really loved it, so it seemed, but a lot of people complained that the jam sessions were just too long. One review said the show that he saw would follow a pattern. The first song was like 18 minutes long. Then 30 seconds into the next song, Ryan would stop the show to yell at a chatty crowd, and that would just continue for hours. And I mean, I hate a chatty audience as much as anybody, but to be honest, the jam has to be fucking awesome to keep a crowd's attention, especially if they weren't expecting a total jam band. You're gonna go see Phish, you expect that. The Cardinals always jammed, sure, but it was a few times in a show, not a nearly 20-minute noodle sesh out the gate. And it seems the shows were long, too. Some didn't have openers, so the Cardinals would take the stage at like 7:40 and leave at like 11:15 with an intermission. That's something Ryan has done for years. I'm a big fan of it personally. I think that more bands that want to play long sets should do intermissions instead of encores. But that's another digression. So, surprise, the reunion wasn't meant to last. Out of the blue, it seemed, all the dates for the Cardinal shows and the solo shows were canceled. The new Cardinals were disbanded. Ryan cited health issues, and he does have an awful-sounding chronic health condition. I believe it's called Meniere's disease. I could be saying that right. It affects the balance in your ears. It's an absolute nightmare diagnosis for a musician. But not all fans were convinced that this is the root of the issue and the cancellations. Related, I saw a thread asking about meet and greets. Apparently, they were something Ryan started the tour with and then ended. Who's to say why? Maybe slow sales for the meet and greets in the shows. Maybe he wasn't feeling it. Who knows? I haven't dug into the live stuff much more than this, but it all makes me sad. So much of this makes me so sad. Even the self-releasing of so much music at once. I know Ryan has always been prolific, but again, Prince wouldn't have released this much music, and Prince released 39 albums in his career. Ryan has already solo released 18 albums and 11 EPs, 21 albums if you count Whiskey Town. Some of those are double albums. I also read some really wild stories about his use of social media. Apparently, he does a lot of lives on Instagram, and fans generally seem to like them. But he seems to post when he's very angry with the world a lot of the times. He berates people for not liking his posts to a weird degree. He gets really mad when he doesn't get likes. He openly shares when he's in battle with his management or when they're all quitting. He says he's sober now, and I hope he is, but it's concerning stuff to see. I'm not gonna sit here and try to diagnose him, but yeah, this does not seem like normal behavior for someone who's nearly 50 years old. He's clearly mad at the world. I get it, he had a lot and he lost a lot. But you have to remember, Ryan Adams has had chance after chance. He's had so many resources pushed his way. He's had so many fans in high places praising his genius. But I think he's just an asshole, and I think he always has been. I hear stories that you know, he's always been like this, and I'm not surprised, because you don't wake up one day and decide to become a sex pest, as far as I know. And right now, even the fans who stood by him after the New York Times article, they seem to feel used. He's extremely demanding of his fans. He always has been, I think. Releasing so much material, playing long shows, these are great things if you're a dedicated fan like I was. And I loved those things about him. But it scares off anyone who isn't ready to fully dive in. Frankly, I'd even stopped buying or listening to all of his releases, even giving them a once through, probably around 2015 or so. And in 2015, I saw him give a great performance at the Ryman Auditorium. There were, and still are, so many records and books and shirts and limited edition this and that to buy. When do you stop? As a fan, when is it enough? I think that secretly, I'd always hoped that Ryan Adams would take a little moment of introspection, maybe a lot of moments, give a sincere apology to the people that he hurt, take blame for their hurt, and change his ways. Take blame, take responsibility, you know what I mean. I still hope that happens, but I'm not going to bet on it. The last thing I want to hit on is the thing we always talk about when an artist behaves badly. Can we separate the art from the artist? Personally, I can't, and I don't think that we should. Ryan Adams has released a lot of incredible music, but so have other people who don't abuse or misuse others. People who don't act like petulant children, who don't sexually harass the women they offer to work with, only to pull away any support when their advances are shrugged off. Everyone's entitled to bad days. That's why I was forgiving of weird voicemails and weird tweets and those feuds. Listen, no one is beloved by every person, not even Dolly Parton, sorry to say. Still, I think that we should work to support people who make great music and aren't their own worst enemy. There are tons of people who make incredible music, and they're not assholes, at least not all the time. That's not fair. I know Ryan Adams is not an asshole all the time, but he's an asshole too much of the time, it seems, and it seems like he's always been that way. He's always been his biggest foil. Again, Ryan Adams is and always has been his biggest enemy. He's had a lot of chances, and he spends them all until the tills are empty. It's a lesson we could all learn from. I think what affects me so much here is that I was a huge fan. I was never nearly the songwriter or singer his other protégés were, but I know that if he'd approached me in the same way, man, I don't know. I feel like that could have been me, and I imagine how hard it was for people who respected him to have their trust turned into sexual harassment. The article says of one of the women he mistreated that she never played another show, and that stuck with me. As someone who felt mistreated in not such a dissimilar way by someone I trusted, and as someone who had her confidence rocked and left music for a while, that hit hard. It really did. Sorry to end on such a bummer of a note, but I want to say thanks for listening to this week's episode of Get Offset. I know that 2023 was not the most consistent year in terms of the podcast. 2024 probably won't be either, but I'm so thankful to have you, and I'm so thankful that you took time out of your day to listen to this. If you like this podcast, we have a Patreon at patreon.com/getoffset. At the $5 and above level, you get a sticker. You also get exclusive Discord access. At the $10 and above level, you get a mug, a Get Offset mug that not even I have. And there's a $25 level where you get a t-shirt, a Get Offset t-shirt. We also have a YouTube. Check that out. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening. Thanks for understanding. Until next time, my name is Emily. Goodbye.